1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. This is Your Turn, a live call-in show featuring spirited discussion and debate about issues that matter to the community. Stay with us to hear what Northwest Florida thinks. Better yet, call in at 623-1330 and tell us what you think. It's Your Turn here on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. Now, here's the host of Your Turn.
Welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. Today is July 14th, 2015. The reason that date may matter is because in history, I am reminded of an agreement that was reached on September 29th, 1938, commonly referred to as the Munich Agreement, when Neville Chamberlain thought we had peace in our time with Adolf Hitler. Less than a year later, the Germans invaded Poland, and World War II was underway. Today, July 14th, 2015, President Barack Obama has announced that he has reached an agreement with the Iranians. Does this mean peace, or does this mean war? Joining us to discuss this, I have in the studio Jerry Gordon, senior editor of the New English Review and its blog, The Iconoclast. Welcome, Jerry.
Good to be back, Mike.
Joining us by telephone, Shoshana Bryan, senior director of the Jewish Policy Center in Washington. Shoshana, welcome.
Thank you, Mike.
And via telephone from Vienna is Omri Sarin, the manager director for press and strategy at the Israel Project. Welcome, Omri.
Good to be here, Mike. Thanks.
So, Omri, you have been in Vienna for a while. What have you been doing there?
So we rolled in here, and I have to actually do some high-level math, I think now 19 days ago, for what should have been about a week of negotiations. And the goal of the Israel Project is working with journalists while they're writing their stories so they know what's going on. You know, and I don't mean that as a knock to journalists. The world is a wide and wonderful place, and journalists have a lot on their plate. And the Iran talks are hopelessly tangled and complicated, something I think we'll be getting into today. And so we came here to work with journalists, for lack of a better way of putting it. And then there was one extension and two extensions and three extensions and a blown deadline here. And now it's July 14th, and we are just wrapping up.
Before we get into the policy of what this actual agreement may include, I have to ask you a question about the journalists. Do they listen? And the reason I ask that question is because there's so much anti-Israel bias in the press. What are you encountering when you're advising the press as to what is happening?
It's an excellent question, and we get that question a lot because, you know, in our world, and I'm sure that you have these folks on, many of them are very close friends of mine, we have a bunch of media watchdog groups that seek to keep the press honest. That's not what we do. You know, the niche in which we work, which is kind of foreign policy and national security, is very often, not exclusively, by no means exclusively, but very often dominated by serious adults who seek to break the news and understand it. Do they get it right all the time? No. Are some of them too caught up with, unfortunately, issues of access and prestige? Are some of them too close to the administration? Yes, undeniably. But they try to get things right. And they want to get things right. And a lot of them are pretty smart. And if you look at kind of the wire coverage that came out of the Vienna talks, much of it was very serious, very issue-based. And, you know, we should talk about this today. There's a very strange thing that's happened in Washington, D.C. If you ask the majority, if you ask journalists, the adults, the 15, 20 people who are serious people who have followed this deal from the beginning 2 years ago, they'll tell you the administration collapsed. This is this for one reason or another, whether it be because of shredding the sanctions regime or giving Iran too much on the weapons side or simply incompetence, they'll tell you that they're against the deal or at least that it's a bad deal. Whereas the pundit class says the opposite. The pundit class, which is beholden to the administration and loves access. And, you know, the stereotype is, but it's not just a stereotype, that they love cocktail parties. They're in support of it. And so we've got a really weird thing going on where the people who follow this deal know that it's a terrible deal, and the people who don't are the most vocal in support of it.
Omri, why is this P5+1 agreement with Iran's nuclear program a danger to both the U.S. and Israel?
You know, I don't know if we have that kind of time today, but there's an overarching reason, and it's an excellent question because that is what people want to know. People don't want to know about the 5-year versus 8-year versus 10-year sunset. They don't want to know about the differences between the heavy water reactor at Iran's plutonium bomb factory at Arak versus the modified one. What they want to know is what is the structure of the deal? And the structure of the deal is very straightforward. This agreement, and this I say this without hyperbole, I say this without partisanship, I say this in a very, for a really, really precise policy way, this agreement has gone from being an agreement that was designed to roll back the Iranian nuclear program to an agreement that now binds the international community to protect and build the Iranian nuclear. It's a dramatic way to say it, and it comes off sounding a little shrill, but let me give you a couple of examples. And the Washington Free Beacon just published an article on this. This agreement says that the Fordo facility, Iran's underground enrichment bunker, that they hollowed out the side of a mountain for a military base, then used it for their covert nuclear work, says instead of closing that, which was always supposed to happen, because why do the Iranians need an enrichment facility carved into the side of a mountain? It'll stay open, and it'll become an international center for nuclear technology. What does that mean? It means that one or more of the great powers will now be working with the Iranians on helping them develop their nuclear technology. And then another thing that somebody discovered in the third of five annexes today, because people are still reading through this final deal. The final deal is 159 pages. Somebody discovered in the third of five annexes that the European Union, along with its partners, has committed to helping the Iranians develop and protect their nuclear program, including against threats of sabotage.
All right, we're going to have to do this because I'm going to put you on hold because we're getting a digital dropout there. Omri is joining us from Vienna, so it's quite a long-distance call there. Meanwhile, Joey's going to see if he can reestablish a better connection. Shoshana, what are you hearing in Washington at the Jewish Policy Center about this deal, which, as Omri said, nobody seems to have read the entire thing yet. We are learning little by little what this includes. What is the opinion so far of the Jewish Policy Center?
I would take a little bit of a little bit of issue with Omri in regard to the pundit class. I think the pundits are split. You have as many pundits disapproving the deal as approving the deal, and I think they are very reflective of various constituencies in the United States who are also very split. For example, in the Jewish community, there is an element that believes any deal is better than no deal. The president said this morning, please think of the alternative to this deal. Think of it, he said, and he left this dramatic pause after he said, think of it. Clearly, he was leaning in the direction of, without the deal, there's war. And there is a group of people, and it's not an insignificant percentage, in the Jewish community that thinks you do anything you can to prevent war. Anything, everything. If you give up stuff, it's okay because you're not having war. There's another group of people in the Jewish community and in the pundit class that says if you give up everything, you're going to end up with war anyway, but from a less advantageous position. We went from Iran that was reeling economically, that didn't have ballistic missile technology, that didn't have and didn't have and didn't have. Now they have money, now they have technology, now they have Western inputs, now they have Western companies in Iran. It's going to be very hard to do anything if you wanted to do sabotage or anything to Iran because you have so many Westerners there. And Omri was getting on that point that if the international community has a delegation at Fordo, well, Fordo is safe because no one's going to take it out if you have international scientists in it.
That's a good point. I think that this deal actually makes Iran more dangerous, much like you have stated, Shoshana, because with a deal in place, Iran will be free to covertly develop nuclear weapons without consequence. And because the only absolute proof that Iran has cheated and developed a nuclear weapon would be a mushroom cloud. So there's no way the West will have the political courage to preemptively stop the Iranian nuclear weapons program militarily. And absent that mushroom cloud, no amount of evidence will convince the world that the Iranians have violated the agreement. But if the day comes when Israel has valid reasons to believe that a nuclear weapon is in the hands of the Iranians or is imminently so, Israel's going to have no choice but to act unilaterally. And when they do, they'll be excoriated and vilified. The world is going to cry, oh, we had a deal. Iran agreed not to build the bombs, but Israel attacked anyway. I think this makes it more dangerous because the military option, as I see it, Shoshana, is off the table.
I'm not sure it wasn't always off the table. I think it was generally off the table. Starting in the Bush administration, the United States and Israel had a divergence of opinion about how to deal with Iran's nuclear program. The Bush administration was in favor of sanctions and believed in squeezing them to death. They were not in favor of military activity, and the Israelis always had believed that military action was best done in conjunction with the United States. Once they began to understand that there was no way, even their good friend George W. Bush was not going to help them do this, the military option became less and less viable. I mean, you have to think about it from the point of view of a small country, Israel, and a large country, Iran, which has air defenses, and which, by the way, will now have better air defenses because the Russians will sell them better air defenses. They've had more time to bury and harden their facilities. They've had more time to dig them under populated places. So if you have to drop a bomb on something, the collateral damage will be there, and it will be very heavy. So I'm not sure that there was a great military option to begin with, but you are right. To the extent that if there was a facility you felt was absolutely, absolutely crucial, I believe Israel could destroy a facility.
Yeah, so, okay, fine. The Bush policy was squeeze them with sanctions. Mm-hmm. The Obama policy is give them $150 billion worth of economic aid to develop their military, both conventional and nuclear. It's absolute insanity from my point. We do have Omri Sarin back from Vienna live on the line. Omri, you were talking about what was happening in Vienna when your phone got garbled, but you're back on with us.
Yeah, sorry about that.
So what are you seeing in Vienna? What have you seen over the last 19 days?
I mean, the relevant dynamic doesn't just go to Vienna. It goes back to Lausanne, to the late March negotiations that ended with the April 2 framework announcement. And what we've seen, and this isn't me talking, this is a journalist who is a centrist journalist, maybe even center-left. And I want to use this quote because I want to put a punctuation mark on an exclamation point on what we said earlier about, you know, observers, neutral observers, not people who are on one side or another, being just terrified of what's going on. So he said, listen, ever since Lausanne, really the first night of Lausanne, the Iranian concessions have stayed the same, and it's just been the Americans seeing what they needed to give in terms of bribes to get the Iranians to accept the deal. And that's really been the dynamic here. And, you know, when we talk about the details of this deal, whether it be the dropping of the conventional arms embargo, which will allow Iran to get precision ballistic missiles in 8 years, which will allow them to, and Shoshana actually is the one to talk to about this, that will allow them to push us out of the Gulf with their anti-ship missiles. Whether it's talking about the collapse on anytime, anywhere inspections, now it'll take the UN's nuclear watchdog 24 days to get into a facility that they want to get into. We risk losing the forest for the trees, and the forest is the Americans giving the Iranians one bribe after another, and then whether it be, I mean, you know, I think that especially people who follow this closely should be worried about the way that the administration has conducted its public discourse, but really it's just irritating. And then to have Secretary Kerry get up and say, and I'm quoting from memory, but I'm not paraphrasing by much, he said something today, something like, some critics have said that I've been rushing to make concessions while I'm here. Nothing could be further from the truth. Well, of course that's the truth.
Omri, did you just say that we have a requirement of 24 days notice before we inspect a facility? I had heard it was 14 days. Is it 24 days notice?
It's 24. So let me foreground this by saying that the text came out about 12 hours ago. It's 159 pages, and it reads like VCR instructions. Every section is, please refer to section 15A followed by section 17C, contextualized by 16D. Like, this is, it requires a flowchart to figure out what's going on. But it seemed very early on that what's actually going on is the IAEA, the UN's nuclear watchdog, will ask for access to a facility. The Iranians will say no. The Iranians have time to request it to, they have time to review the request. If they drag it out to the end and say no on the last day, it then goes out to an arbitration committee. An arbitration committee, which, by the way, the Iranians sit on. And then that arbitration committee has to take its time, and then the Iranians have a chance to respond. And only if they then don't respond does it maybe go to a violations committee. Does the IAEA maybe refer it back to the United Nations Security Council? But yes, as of this morning, the read was 24 days, and there were several lawmakers. There were several hearings this morning at the on the Hill at the House, on the House side, about this specific issue, where the number that was assumed by both lawmakers was 24 days, and that was the basis for the discussion.
Well, whether it's 14 days or 24 days, it's outrageous. It should be 14 minutes or maybe 24 minutes. It's absurd to give them days' notice. We have to take a quick break, and then we will continue our conversation with Jerry Gordon, Shoshana Bryan, and Omri Sarin right here on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's talk radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. With me in the studio, Jerry Gordon, senior editor of the New English Review and its blog, The Iconoclast. You can find Jerry online at www.newenglishreview.org. Joining us by telephone from Washington, D.C., Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center. You can find Shoshana online at www.jewishpolicycenter.org. And by telephone from Vienna is Omri Sarin, the Managing Director for Press and Strategy at the Israel Project. You can find Omri online at www.theisraelproject.org.
Omri, there's a kind of a topsy-turvy mystery event connected with the lifting of travel bans and asset sequesters for none other than the commanding officer of the Quds Force, General Qasem Soleimani. What is all that about?
This is surreal, Jerry. It's surreal. So the Iranians appear to have handed the Americans, and I'm saying this intentionally with a tone of exasperation, because I think everyone in who's observing this is just baffled by what has happened. Part of the concessions that we made to the Iranians involved lifting sanctions on about 800 of their entities and their individuals, including Qasem Soleimani, a man who has the blood of hundreds of Americans on his hands. Hundreds. And people are looking in the minutes and hours after the text is released. Journalists were looking through the list of people who will have sanctions lifted on them and Qasem Soleimani's name on there. And they take it to the administration and they say, what is going on? And you know what the administration told them? They said this, multiple U.S. sources said, that's not Qasem Soleimani, the Quds Force commander that has the blood of Americans on his hands. That's a different Qasem Soleimani. So journalists asked, which Qasem Soleimani is it? And then they were told, we don't know. It turns out, according to both Iranian and American sources, that is the Qasem Soleimani that has American blood on his hands. The Fars news agency, Iran's state-run news agency, tweeted that Qasem Soleimani, boasting Qasem Soleimani taken off the sanctions list, and then they sent a link to the actual document that identifies him by name and number. And by tonight, you know, outlets like ABC News had confirmed that indeed he'll have his travel ban and his foreign assets unfrozen. So there are two things going on here. And, you know, this is really a microcosm for how the administration has approached these entire talks and how they've approached critics of these talks, even constructive critics. First, they made a mistake born of incompetence, and second, they lied about it.
That's incredible.
Look, I'd like to be a little bit of a cynic here, by the way. Yes, Qasem Soleimani is who he is, and it's outrageous that the travel ban on him is lifted. But this is the administration who hosted the communist Vietnamese government, which killed 58,000 American soldiers in the Vietnam War, never apologized, never made clean, never said they wanted to get past that. They simply went on being communists and all the rest of those things. And he was vetted by the White House. So these are people who don't care. Dead Americans are dead Americans. They're gone. They're finished. And so if you can wipe out 58,000 Vietnam casualties, not to mention hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese casualties of the war, you can certainly wipe out the 500 or so Americans in Bush's war in Iraq, can't you?
Well, I'm actually more concerned. I'm not so much concerned about Soleimani. I mean, sure, it's an issue. I'm more concerned about the 7 million people living in Israel, the 300 million people in the United States. I'm concerned that Iran has been given a pathway to a bomb that is unobstructed, because as I said a moment ago, and I think actually, Omri, you were getting reconnected at the time, but this takes the military option off the table, because even if Israel believes that their existential threat is imminent, they can hardly attack militarily to stop it, because the world will condemn them by saying, hey, we had a deal. What's Israel doing attacking? That piece of paper said that they wouldn't develop a bomb. So, I mean, I realize this is an issue about a single terrorist, but gosh, I think the concessions are so much bigger than that. Am I wrong, Omri?
Well, let me make the case in two ways. The first is, you know, Shoshana's answer, I think, was very, very compelling when you guys were talking about this earlier, which is the military option was never Israel's main option. Sabotage and subterfuge were Israel's main options, which is why it's so concerning that this deal puts the Iranian nuclear program under international sponsorship. You know, there's going to be a facility now where we'll work with the Iranians on nuclear technology. There's an annex to the deal that says we're going to teach them, the E3 and their partners, the European 3 and the partners will teach them how to harden their nuclear assets against sabotage, specifically against nuclear sabotage. We're protecting them as they build up their program. Forget protecting them in the last 5 minutes from Israeli action. This deal protects them from Israeli action throughout the entire lifetime of the deal. And then the second thing is,
we'll have to get to the second thing. We'll have to get to the second thing when we get back from the news, because we got a break in 8 seconds. And then when we do get back, we will continue the conversation about what is happening with this Iranian nuclear weapons deal when Your Turn continues on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to Your Turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. With me in the studio, Jerry Gordon, senior editor of the New English Review and his blog, The Iconoclast, Shoshana Bryan, senior director of the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, and Omri Sarin, managing director for press and strategy at the Israel Project. He's joining us from Vienna. Omri, we had to break for the bottom of the hour news right before you got to part two regarding Qasem Soleimani. What's part two?
Part two is this isn't just a guy, although he is just a guy, because his personal importance is overstated by the West because there's this myth about him. But there's an article tonight published by Lee Smith in the Weekly Standard that I think is worth talking about, just if we have a couple seconds, about Qasem Soleimani, because the article says, listen, this deal was in a very real way, in a metaphorical way, but in a real way, struck between Obama and Qasem Soleimani, because what is actually at stake in the deal? Why are we effectively funding their conventional buildup by giving them $150 billion and dropping all of our arms embargo against them? Why are we effectively building up their nuclear program by putting it under the protection of the international community and protecting it from sabotage? And the argument that is made in this article is that Obama, and I'm quoting, likes Soleimani and admires his work, and it quotes the president telling Arab officials that they really need to, you know, get their business together and, quote, learn from Iran's example. The figure of Qasem Soleimani stands in for the idea that Iran is taking over the region. And the fact that we're lifting the ban on his travel and unfreezing his assets is being read by a lot of people as evidence that, yes, this deal is designed explicitly to reintegrate Iran into the regional structure in the Middle East and into the community of nations, because the president sees the Islamic Republic as a stabilizing force. And so the lifting the travel ban on the one guy who more than anyone else stands in for Iran's regional expansionism and its efforts to take over the Levant and to take over the Gulf is goes beyond just, you know, the idea that this one guy gets to travel. It's the guy who gets to travel who's trying to bring the entire Middle East under Iran's thumb.
Armory, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham today suggested that the announcement of this deal was the moral equivalent of a declaration of war against Israel. Given this discussion that we've had with both you and Shoshana, what options does Israel have at this time to combat this deal?
Very few. You know, critics of the president who come at it from the pro-Israel perspective, one of the criticisms that they make is obviously that this kind of deal is very bad for Israel, but a second criticism they make is the deal hems in Israel. And the point that Shoshana made earlier, which is, and that several people have made earlier on this today in this discussion, that it really constrains the Israelis' options, whatever options they have, is one of the criticisms. The Israelis have options. They have options. They have deterrent options. Some of them they like to talk about. Some of them they don't. There are discussions about them right now. But many of the Israelis have become fatalistic about this. They're going to buy some more assets, and they're going to dig in.
Shoshana, do you have any views on that?
I have nothing but views, Jerry. But let me start by where Omri ended, which is to say that the Obama administration is allowing Iran and encouraging Iran to be a regional player. The goal of the administration is to get out of the region. So one of the reasons you want to build up Iran's conventional capabilities, and I would suggest mini-submarines are going to be very big, mine-laying ships are going to be very big, is that the United States is planning to leave the Persian Gulf, at least in the main, at least in the broadest sense, and rely on Iran and Iran's hegemony to pass oil out of the Persian Gulf, okay? So you won't have the United States in the Persian Gulf in the way that it is there today. That's a terrible thing for Israel because Israel relies on the United States in the broadest sense to keep the peace in the region. You see what happens when strong military powers disappear. Bashar Assad disappeared, Saddam Hussein disappeared, Muammar Gaddafi disappeared, and all you got was chaos. And the Israelis are concerned that if the United States actually leaves the Persian Gulf region, there will be more chaos. The administration doesn't see it that way. So as Omri says, the Israelis have to figure out what next from their point of view. One of the things that has been bandied about a little bit in Israel, but a lot in the United States, is how Israel should deal with the notion of its own capabilities. There are things that people presume about Israel's defensive and offensive capabilities that the Israelis don't talk about. Dare I say, there are those who suspect that Israel has a nuclear program. It may be time, according to some people, for Israel to decide whether or not it wishes to address that subject publicly as a deterrent so that the Iranians are clear that should they make a move, the Israelis are able to make a counter move. The Iranians will have first strike capability at some point. If they don't have it already, one of the things that we don't know is what we don't know in terms of Iran's capabilities now. Israel may have first strike capability. It may have second strike capability. There are all kinds of things it could have. And if Israel were to decide to lay those things on the table, it may provide a deterrent to the Iranians.
Well, the supreme leader of Iran has gone on record already saying that the Islamic world can take an attack from Israel, but Israel is a one-strike-and-they're-out nation. So they're willing, the Iranians, at least publicly, have said they're willing to take the casualties as long as it means Israel being wiped off the planet. The Muslims win. They're happy with it.
Well, he says that now. I don't think he'd say that if something was aimed at Tehran. These guys are all ready to sacrifice the last other guy, not willing to sacrifice themselves. So I think that's a bit of hyperbole. There's a lot of hyperbole that comes with dealing with Iran.
There always has been. Very true. Shoshana, what is the role of Congress in this? Did Congress completely abdicate any role in this with the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act?
It's sort of like Obamacare. Obamacare, a single Republican vote. which, according to the Republicans, was a great thing, and I agree that it was. It was party discipline that was excellent. And they'll likely get that on this deal as well. At the end of the day, did it matter? Is Obamacare the law of the land? Yes, it is. Did it help Republicans get elected to office? Yes, it did. But Obamacare is still the law of the land. So they'll probably get 100% of the Republicans. They may get 10% of the Democrats, maybe. But it's not enough to override a veto. And unless they have a veto-proof majority in both houses, it's one thing to be pure, and it's another to win. So I don't see them winning.
Well, let's ask even more into the genesis of this. Why isn't this being treated as a treaty? Did the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act take the two-thirds of the Senate requirement for a treaty off the table and simply make it a simple majority and only a veto override gets Congress's way? It seems to me the whole act was somewhat upside down.
Well, yes, it is upside down, and it is not a treaty, and it doesn't require two-thirds of the Senate. And to some people's way of thinking, that's actually good, because the White House treats it like an executive agreement. Presidents can make executive agreements of all sorts with all kinds of people. Other presidents are not bound by them. So if it were to be a Republican president next time, or simply a president who finds this deal problematic, it's only an executive agreement. It can die with the Obama administration. So it's conceivable that that's okay.
But Shoshana, Congress, in Article 1, Section 8, has the right to regulate commerce with foreign nations. Iran is a foreign nation. Trade is commerce. So has Congress abdicated that responsibility?
Congress has laid restrictions on trade with Iran. That's what the sanctions are, the congressional sanctions. And those sanctions, in theory, will not come off unless the president end runs them. There is some thought that he'll call the non-nuclear sanctions nuclear sanctions, then he'll lift them. The sanctions that are being lifted immediately are executive sanctions and Security Council resolution sanctions. And those are not subject to congressional review.
Okay.
Omri, hearing this discussion, what is the risk in this region that non-proliferation dies and the opposite occurs? Essentially, what I'm talking about is the possibility of Saudi Arabia calling in a marker, for example, from Pakistan that it helped to fund its so-called Islamic bomb factory, and that Turkey perhaps does the same thing. And Egypt has already gone on record of essentially doing the same. Is that the obvious aspect of the opening of this Pandora's box?
Not just obvious, but well-nigh undeniable. And, you know, we talked earlier, a lot of what's dangerous about this administration's communication with American lawmakers and with the American public is they just don't tell the truth, right? The Soleimani thing, or their approach to when they make excuses for Iranian cheating. They just don't tell the truth. But another aspect that has been widely remarked upon is they say really insultingly stupid things in order to defend their policies. So one great example is their answers to the potential that Saudi Arabia will respond to a bad deal by going nuclear. And let's be clear, Saudi Arabia will respond to a bad deal by going nuclear. The Saudis have not been bashful about this. They have told us in as many words that they will not wait to gain their own nuclear capabilities until the Iranians get a nuclear bomb. They've said that they will respond with their own infrastructure when they believe that it's now inevitable that the Iranians will get a nuclear bomb. And they have said as well that they believe that this deal makes it inevitable that Iran gets a nuclear bomb, which is correct. And so you have these very, very clear declarations from a traditional American ally that sits on the world's that sits at the center of the world's energy breadbasket, that they intend to go nuclear in response to this deal. And if they go nuclear, then the entire deal is trashed, because there is no chance that the Iranian military will permit the Sunnis to have a bomb without them getting a bomb. They'll respond by backing out of the deal. Now, this is obviously a worst-case catastrophe for the White House. You end up in a world, right now, the world is, or yesterday, the world was no deal and no Iranian bomb. Now you'll have no deal and, yes, an Iranian bomb. So what have their responses been? And I don't want to overemphasize this, but it's difficult not to be, not to sort of notice that what we have is now, in this specific context, your question, will the Saudis go nuclear? We have a scenario that will trash everything the administration has hoped to create. All cost, no benefit. What is their answer? Their answer is two things. One is they say the Saudis are too poor to go nuclear, which is insane, given the example of North Korea, and given the example of, and given what we know about Saudi Arabia's GDP and how they allocate their money. And the second thing they've said, and this has been said by one of the top Iran hands at the NSC, wrote a pamphlet about it, in fact, that the Saudis will never go nuclear because they're afraid of an international oil embargo. I'm sorry, that's not a sophisticated argument. It's an insultingly stupid argument. And yet, the entire success of the deal, and more so, the potential that the deal will fail but leave a poly-nuclear Middle East in its wake, rests on these two, frankly, terrible arguments, and yet here we are.
Well, and when you look at the reasons behind having a nuclear weapon, I must concede, I completely understand why the Iranians want one. When the North Koreans got one, we pretty much left them alone. This despite President Clinton saying that we've reached a deal to prevent North Korea from obtaining nuclear weapons. He said that on October 21st, 1994. How did that work out? But you look at nations like Ukraine. We convinced them to give up their nuclear weapons, and we told them, we'll protect you against invasion. Well, recently Ukraine was invaded and we didn't protect them. So if the Saudis don't feel they are under our umbrella, I completely understand that. Am I wrong?
No, that's an excellent point, and it really can't be overemphasized. The overarching American argument is the Saudis won't go nuclear because they trust us to protect them against Iran. No, they don't. They don't trust us because, in general, when it comes to our security assurances, to our nuclear-related security assurances, they watched how we hollowed out what's called the Budapest Memorandum, which is where we promised Ukraine that if they give up their nukes, we will protect their territorial integrity. The Saudis look at that and say the Americans can't be relied upon to keep their promises when it comes to nukes. And then they look at the specific kinds of promises that we made. We very, very, very famously, the Obama administration famously, it's not public, but famously, told the Israelis in 2012 and 2013, don't attack Iran, and if you don't, I promise you, we will not screw you on this. Don't attack Iran. Let us pursue diplomacy. If it goes bad, we promise you, we won't let this go sideways for you. And then the Israelis did. They listened to us. They took us at our word. And then fast forward 2 years, the president's team is on the verge, this was a couple months ago, is on the verge of striking a bad deal with Iran. And you have one of the president's top advisors anonymously telling The Atlantic that, I don't know if I can say this on radio.
Chicken poop.
Anonymously chicken poop. Calling Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu chicken poop for believing the Americans who promised him that they'd have his back. The Saudis look at this and they say the Americans can't be relied upon when it comes to Iran and when it comes to nuclear weapons. And they're going to chart their own course. And that course is going to be destructive to the region, and destructive because it's destructive to the region, to global energy security and global security in general, to say nothing of probably a bad idea to have nuclear weapons floating around a region of the world that has four hot wars and a bunch of states that are disintegrating.
And let me throw a caveat in there, which is that just because Israel and Saudi Arabia find themselves on the same side of the Iran problem at the moment, the nuclearization of Saudi Arabia is a huge problem for Israel. We should not make too much of this temporary marriage of convenience in which the Saudis really hope the Israelis will take care of the Iranians for them. This will not be a good thing for Israel.
Omni Sarin, you mentioned the article in The Atlantic. The chicken poop comment is what got all the press. But that actually, to me, was not the worst phrase in there. The worst phrase that I saw was when they also said that the Obama administration said, quote, it's too late, meaning they basically were conceding that the Iranians will one day get the bomb, and it looks like today they paved the pathway to that. We have to take a quick break, and then we will come back and we will wrap up this conversation. Keep in mind that we do have another hour on the other side of Top of the Hour News, but we'll be right back with more of Your Turn on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to Your Turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. With me in the studio, Jerry Gordon, senior editor of the New English Review and his blog, The Iconoclast, online at www.newenglishreview.org. Shoshana Bryan, senior director of the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, online at www.jewishpolicycenter.org. And Omri Sarin, the managing director for press and strategy at the Israel Project, online at www.theisraelproject.org.
This is a jump ball question to the both of you. Has Iran actually, in the bizarre world of the Middle East, actually boosted the Islamic State?
The answer is yes.
Absolutely. It's not even a close debate.
And Shoshana?
Look, Iran is trying to create that thing we used to talk about in the 80s, because I'm quite old, called the Shiite Crescent. Iran's goal is to start in Iran, go across Iraq, across Syria, across Lebanon, to the Mediterranean. In order to do that, they have to be well entrenched, well dug in Iraq. Part of what they need to do that is chaos in the Sunni areas of Iraq. So it's in their interest to allow the Islamic State a certain amount of leeway to create chaos. And then they come in and they say, look, now it's better to be with us than to be with them. We'll take care of you. You notice that Islamic State is not in the Shiite areas, it's in the Sunni areas. So it works to Iran's interest to create this chaos and then solve the chaos. They did the same thing in Yemen with the Houthis. They create the chaos, and they want to resolve the chaos by being in charge of Yemen. It's standard operating procedure for Iran.
Omri, any comments on that, Omri?
Yeah, it's absolutely true, and Shoshana's point can't be emphasized enough that they mostly stay in Sunni areas. You know, there was a study by a London-based human rights organization, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, that found that somewhere between 12% and 18% of ISIS attacks were on the regime. The rest were against moderates and Sunni rivals. It's not just that Iran gets to swoop in and, and they've done this successfully, by the way, with the Americans, say, we're going to take care of this problem. That's, you know, and there are Americans who say we should arm Iran so that it can better take on the Islamic State. But it's also that these groups stay out of their way. There's a tacit understanding. Everybody knows what's going on, which is Shia extremists and Sunni extremists trying to carve out their own enclaves and killing the moderates in between. And that is not, you know, that's not conspiracy theory. It's what the numbers show.
Well, this agreement that was announced today, in my view, is a travesty. Neville Chamberlain believed that Adolf Hitler would keep his end of the agreement. Barack Obama knows the Iranians will not. So Chamberlain can be forgiven for his ignorance and foolishness, but Barack Obama is doing this deliberately with full knowledge of what the end result will be. And since Barack Obama knows that the Iranians won't honor this agreement, what does that say about Barack Obama's real goal? That's a question that can't be answered today, but I guarantee we will be having these conversations again in the future. Jerry Gordon, Shoshana Bryan, Omri Sarin, thank you all for joining us. We've got another hour of Your Turn coming up right after the news when Your Turn continues on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio.